91.3 WLRN presents Topical Currents. This afternoon we present another At Your Service program, this time with acclaimed technology law contributor, attorney Mark Grossman. Good afternoon, Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman. Mark Grossman was a pioneer in tech law. He started in the mid-1990s, long before many of the key issues, such as social media, even existed. A special part of today's tech program is a primer in the art of negotiation. No matter how technically complicated a deal may be, timeless negotiation techniques usually win the day. The ability to listen, to understand another party's concerns, and to extend some concessions will usually result in successful negotiation. There's more, of course, including your questions. First, it's news. We return with today's Topical Currents. It's Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman. Today's guest is attorney Mark Grossman, a pioneer expert in technology law.
He's written an ongoing column about the topic for more than 20 years and authored two editions of the book, Technology Law, What Every Business and Business-Minded Person Needs to Know.
He's a featured keynote speaker on the business circuit and is seen frequently on national TV news programs. He joins us again in the studio. Welcome to you, Mark Grossman.
Good afternoon, Joe and Bonnie.
Hi.
We have an
Happy
hour
to be
ahead
here.
Of us.
We do, and we're going to start with negotiation, which is something you've been doing, negotiating, for many years. I was wondering whether you considered it an art or a skill.
Ha. It's a little of both, but it is a skill, and people who think that they can walk into a negotiation and there's nothing to know about negotiating because you just wing it and figure it out are easy prey. There is a lot to it. There are strategies that are somewhat universal, and the starting point is prior planning prevents poor performance, so winging it is not necessarily a good idea.
PPP. You say that every great leader is a great negotiator, but what makes a great negotiator?
Well, I think there are two key parts to, at the most fundamental level, to being a great negotiator. One, great listener. Got to be able to hear the other side's questions. I'm a big advocate, certainly early in a negotiation, of being what I call an investigational negotiator. So I ask questions, I keep my mouth shut, I ask drill down questions and follow up questions when I get half an answer. I lubricate the conversation with a little information, but the bottom line is, my position is that I know what my wants, needs, and agenda are going in. What I need to know, though, are your wants, needs, and agenda. And if I'm yapping, I'm not listening, and I'm not learning about your wants and needs and agenda. So number one is be a great listener. And number two is empathy. You've got to be good. You have to be empathetic to the other side if you're going to be a great negotiator. So, even if the other side's position is insane, and it may be, it's their insanity.
But empathy is considered by many to be innate, or at least it's usually something one learns from an early age. Can you really teach someone to be empathetic, or are you merely teaching them to act empathetic?
Is it different? I mean, maybe it is.
Yes.
Maybe it is, but for the purposes of a negotiation, if you have an inherently non-empathetic kind of person, I would suggest it might be possible to teach them to act empathetic, to begin to analyze things with empathy, begin to, as I say often, feel the other side's pain. Just kind of switch seats. What are they feeling? Why are they objecting to this particular point, whatever point it is, and begin to see it from their perspective to begin to problem solve compromise solutions.
But then again, you don't want to empathize too much.
No, you don't. You don't want to empathize to the point that you're giving it away. In fact, the flip side is you'd love them to be empathetic to your position. And this is why it's not just horse trade back and forth. It's rhetoric. It's talking. It's explaining why. In fact, why is in some ways the most important question you can ask during a negotiation, especially if you're at an impasse. And it's sort of like you're banging heads with each other and it's like, throw it out there. It's like, why is this your position? Don't assume you know. And then kick back and listen. One time I had this deal and we were talking about a non-compete. So we were going to buy, my client was going to buy a ton of stuff from this. The other side said, but you can't, it was going to be an exclusive. You can't sell this to anyone else. And we were going to like triple their revenue overnight. It was like they kept pushing back. No, can't do that. Can't do that. Finally, I said, why? I said, well, we have this small exclusive or small deal with this other company, and every year we're supposed to sell them X amount. It's like, okay, why don't we make an exception to the exclusive relationship? Because I don't really care about your small sale to this other company. And I got there by asking the question, why?
Now, negotiation, you're talking about business and law, but of course it comes into every facet of our lives, really, between in relationships, you know, be they at work, at home, whatever. So do we want to invite our listeners to
talk? Of course, even buying a car has some good examples.
Well, that's the classic.
That's the classic that we all love the most. But yeah.
So our number is 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-WLRN. Our email is radio@WLRN.org, and we ask you to keep your emails brief. Okay, so what does it mean to grow the pie?
I've often been known to say that a good negotiator splits the pie, divides the pie, and a great negotiator grows the pie. A great negotiator looks at a business deal and doesn't just figure out, well, you know, let me see if I get 60% of the value that's on the table. A great negotiator figures out how to get 100% of the total value that's on the table to 125%. Find out a way to get more for everybody and divide that up rather than just divide what's on the pie. And that's one of the things that a great negotiator does.
Would you touch on fair and not win-win? Everyone goes in wanting win-win.
Right.
I don't believe in win-win. And people think I'm crazy when I say that. I think it's a feel-good kind of phrase. You read stuff online or in magazines about negotiating. It's always win-win-win-win-win. I don't believe in it. You know, if it's a zero-sum game, if we're negotiating the price of a car, you talked about cars, for every dollar that it moves, someone wins and somebody loses. That's not win-win. But I do believe in the concept of fair-fare. Fair-fare, rough justice. It's sort of like whether it's something as simplistic as a car negotiation or a negotiation over employment, salary, benefits, time off, title, and other things that might come up in a employment negotiation. Whatever it is, there is this range of fair for everybody.
But what if you're dealing with somebody who's not fair?
That's a tough one. And the starting point might be that you may not want to do business with it, but let's assume that you do want to do business.
Or that you have to.
You have to do business with them. At that point, even if they're not fair, I guess the answer becomes you're not going to agree to a deal until you've entered that middle range of fair, whether they like it or not. I guess the answer is if you can't get them to a fair middle ground, a fair area, which actually may not be the middle, but to that fair area, the answer is walk away. The best deal you're going to cut in any context is a deal you're willing to walk away from. So if you're not going to be fair with me, Bonnie, I don't have to do business with you. I mean, that is the bottom line. I mean, here's where I think the fair range is for both of us, and we can discuss details. But bottom line, Bonnie, if you don't want to work in that area, let's just call it a day. And that's when I'm going to cut a good deal, because I may walk and you may call me the next day and say, let's sit down again. Let's try to work a deal, or not. But nothing forces me to do business with you if you're going to be unfair with me.
Or a bully. You mentioned that, too. That you need to just completely shut down when a bully keeps hammering away.
Never give in to a bully. And this goes to the concept that life is a negotiation. Because this is true in life. It's true in a complex business negotiation. It's true in your personal life. You don't give in to a bully in any context. But let's take it to that business negotiation. Someone's pounding their shoe on the table, a la Khrushchev at the United Nations. They're yelling at you. They're cursing at you. You know, a decent negotiator might just say, I'm not doing business with you. I don't like your attitude. I don't like you. I'm out of here. A great negotiator calls a timeout, though. Doesn't give in, but it's like, you know what, Joe, if you're going to talk to me like that, I'm not going to continue this today. why don't we set another meeting on another day when you have your act together a little bit and walk? So I guess the point is, there are a couple of points. One, don't give in to a bully. Two, don't cut and run. But three is, I think what a great negotiator does is call a timeout and picks it up another day. There, no complex deal gets done in a single sitting anyway. A negotiation's a process, not a moment in time.
I'm thinking that even applies, like if you have a child who's in a tantrum, you know, which in a way is akin to bullying at that moment.
Yes, I was always a big advocate of the timeout. If my daughter were here, I'd ask her, she's now 30. So what'd you think of all your timeouts in retrospect? I mean, it turned out sort of okay.
Yeah.
Yes, it is. And a timeout to a child, I guess, is the metaphorical equivalent to, why don't we pick this up another
right.
day in an adult negotiation over a sophisticated business deal?
Now, you say use your knowledge of psychology to aid negotiation, but many people don't have a knowledge of psychology.
Well, but to some extent.
You're talking about common sense stuff?
Common sense, little tips. Here, psychology. You have, this is just one example, you have a really difficult point to raise in the negotiation. I know that when I raise this point to Bonnie and Joe, they're going to start yelling at me. They're going to be unhappy with me. They're not going to want to really do business with me. I think it's a human tendency to do the following. It's like, let's negotiate the easy stuff. I don't want to get them pissed off. I don't want them ending this discussion. So let's do the easy stuff. I'm going to suggest that you do the exact opposite. Try this as a psychological tactic. When you have something difficult to raise in a negotiation, raise it early. Argue about it and then say, hey, why don't we table this and come back to it later? When you come back to it 2 weeks later, funny thing happens. The mere passage of time makes the unacceptable more acceptable.
That I found interesting. Expand on that, because are you saying that we become inured to, you know, unacceptable things over time?
We get used to them.
We have to.
You know what? Here's the best example. You know, everyone who's listening right now has had something bad happen in their life. Death in the family, an illness, something. And some well-meaning friend has probably said something like, time will make it better. I would suggest to you that if time could make that personal disaster better, which it does, doesn't cure it, but it makes it better, it can deal with you, help you in a business negotiation also.
We're speaking with Mark Grossman, and attorney, author, negotiator, talking about negotiation now. We're going to expand to other things. Again, our number 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-WLRN, email radio@WLRN.org.
And we're back. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman. As we mentioned, we have some lines open if you'd like to join in with a question or a comment. That's easy enough. 1-800-743-9576. 1-800-743-WLRN. Also email, that's radio@WLRN.org. radio@WLRN.org. Mark, we've made a lot of references to buying a car, maybe even including, say, buying a home. And you mentioned that when you're buying a car, and I think maybe if you're negotiating any sort of big purchase, that the seller's time is very important to them. And you say to make sure they use it, that you use it properly. Does that mean to just kind of keep a shell up and make them kind of work harder to make you agreeable to their terms?
At the most basic level, Joe, it's about causing the other side in any negotiation to invest some time and effort with you.
Say, we've invested so much time, therefore maybe we will look at this a little differently.
Yeah, I mean, think about it. Whatever it is, doesn't matter if it's a sophisticated business deal or the simple transaction with a car deal. When I go to a car dealer, I always do the test drive, for example. And I do the test drive even if I've had five of them in that same model in other dealerships, because I want the salesman to spend time with me. While we're bopping around the neighborhood, I mean, he or she could be doing something else, but they've now devoted time to me. And I'm just suggesting as a tactic that the more time and effort the other side has invested in you, the more aggressive they're likely to be in their willingness to reach compromise and a negotiated solution. When I have 10 minutes with you.
So if you go in there and say, I've read all of the reports, all of the reviews, I know this is the car I want, get the order out.
Let's get to price. You have a zero-sum game going on now. He's not invested in you. He's got no. It's like, let's see if I could cut a quick one or not, or he's out of here. But you know what? When I've come back three or four times, burned his ear, asked questions, looked at all the different upholsteries, talked about the financing options, come back multiple times, and when we finally get serious about price, this salesperson is invested in, like, I am going to make some money from this guy.
What do you mean when you say to never bring more authority to the table than the other side when buying a car? What does that mean?
I'll give you an example that occurred to me. One time I take my daughter, she's like 12, to buy a car with me. I was going to teach her how to buy a car. And we're going back and forth with price. Finally agree on a price. And salesman does the purchase order. I sign the purchase order. He says, I got to take it to the sales manager for signature. And when he comes back, so, well, your sales manager said I'm a terrible negotiator and you outwitted me and he's going to fire me. And he dramatically writes a new and higher price on the purchase order. I realize in that situation that I made a fundamental mistake. I brought too much authority to the table. I'm sitting there as a decision maker. I can go up in price. I can go down in price. I can add features. Meanwhile, the salesperson,
so you should have had your daughter do the initial negotiations.
I did. When he wouldn't let the sales manager see me, I look at the salesman and I say, okay, if I can't talk to your sales manager, here's how we're doing this. I'm going to the car. You talk to my daughter. She'll relay messages to me. You go relay messages to your manager. And this is how we're going to do this. My daughter looked at me at this point. She says, Dad, are you nuts? I'm only 12. And I'm telling mommy when we get home. But I did it anyway. And you know what? Three rounds of that and I got my sales manager. Just saying.
Well, yeah, that's the frustrating thing is that you're always but when you're getting a car, you rarely get the manager. You're usually getting the salesman.
Bring a 12-year-old. And go to the car.
They're playing good cop, bad cop,
of
too.
Of course, it's a game. But the fundamental issue is you never want to, it comes back to your initial question, never bring more negotiating power to the table. So in a sophisticated technology deal, which is my core as a professional negotiator, I don't bring my CIO, my chief information officer, to the table to meet with a salesperson. No. You're not talking to my decision maker to have you run it up the flagpole on the other side with no authority so that my decision maker is making concessions to a messenger. Never make concessions to a messenger. Never make concessions to someone with less authority than you have at the table.
Should we ever trust something that's agreed upon verbally that's not in a contract?
You know, that's an interesting question. I mean, yes, sometimes we should. I know that's crazy coming from a lawyer and someone will sue me for malpractice for it. But, okay, our word should be our bond. And in the right context, with the right risk assessment, what could I lose? You know, how much do I trust this person? Yes. Should you do a multi-million-dollar corporate deal on the back of a napkin or on a handshake? Of course not. But you know what? There are it's all about risk assessment. As a lawyer, what do I do? As a professional negotiator, what do? I assess risk. And risk is never zero, but there are situations where I might say, you know what? The risk is low. The potential loss is low. He seems trustworthy. Let's go for it. So it's never, the advice is never accept verbals. Just understand your risk. And when the risk is substantial enough, get yourself a good contract.
What about by email? I mean, should it be face-to-face or email? Email, at least you have a paper trail.
Email is a terrible way to negotiate.
Is it?
Yeah, it is. I mean, there's something, the platinum standard today with all our technology is still looking you in the eyes, reading you, reading the situation, reading the table, reading those around me. Email's good for just confirming the following three understandings we reached today as we work towards a definitive agreement. And it's like, are we on the same page? Email's good for setting appointments. Email's good for here are the numbers to be clear. Okay, but as far as things that are complex, where there are feelings involved, where there's a give and take going on, email's a monologue. And when we're having a conversation during a negotiation, I can be looking at you. I can be speaking in sound bites and letting right. you come back at me. But to write, spend hours carefully crafting a three-page monologue, it's generally ineffective.
And it's easy to offend in email.
Oh, my God.
Or it's easy to infer offense.
You can't. I consider myself a good writer, a professional writer. I mean, it is so hard to accurately convey emotion. And I would just suggest winky faces and smiley faces are a really crude way. practically our entire
but
vocabulary.
But sometimes they're used to mitigate things.
Yes, but they're so crude. It's such a limited vocabulary. I mean, really, a two-word emotional vocabulary. Now, many women have accused men of that is their emotional vocabulary, but that's an entirely different subject.
That's a different conversation.
Yeah, different conversation. And I'm happy to go there if you want.
Okay, again, our number is 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-WLRN. Our email is radio@WLRN.org. So you have a list of things you never say.
Yes, you've read my stuff. So things you never say include things like, that is the best agreement I've ever seen. It's like, that comes from my client right before I'm about to raise 100 issues on the first draft of the agreement. I mean, that's an example of things you never say. The most I could spend is the following, is your opening statement.
Why is that bad? Like if you go to a car dealer and you say, this is how much I want to spend, that's bad?
First of all, you weren't listening to the car dealer. I mean, you don't want to lead with the most you can spend. One, if you say it to me, I assume you're lying. So it's don't start with a lie. I mean, integrity and truthfulness have a place in a negotiation, believe it or not.
That's good.
So when you lead with a lie, that concerns me right off the top. But beyond that, there's just, you don't want to tell them your budget. You don't want to tell them your deadline. I mean, if you tell me you have to do a deal, what are we in May now, May 10, whatever it is. If you tell me that you have to do a deal by May 31 or the world as you know it ends, I'm not even going to engage with you seriously until May 28th. Why?
Because
I know that I have less time to make concessions. And you're signing on May 31. You've told me you have no alternatives. There's no one else you're shopping. The world ends. It's like, okay, you know what? I'm going to Europe for the next 18 days. Catch you on the 28th. Why don't we work it out then? Obviously, I exaggerate the stated reason, but you get my point. That's another example of things you never say.
All right. Joe?
Let's go to a quick caller here. George in Fort Lauderdale. You're up. Hi.
Hello.
Hello there. Go ahead.
Hi. My comment is that, you know, I realized this years ago. I think it's true that it's all, the whole bottom line is the power to walk away, or that is the ability or the desire just to walk away. You know, like Trump says in his book, The Art of the Deal, you know, the other party has to, you know, want something very badly and so forth.
I've always said, I didn't invent the line, but the best deal you're going to cut is the deal you're willing to walk away from. If I smell that you need this badly, that impacts the way I'm going to negotiate with you. But when you put fear in me that you're going to walk, that you have other alternatives and are quite happy to use them if I'm not...
Well, maybe you don't.
there's the art of the bluff, right? But in doing sophisticated business deals, one of the things I recommend to my client, especially when we're dealing with a vendor, let's say, or whatever context, is you should, in theory, be negotiating with two sides at the same time so that you're never in a position where you only have one alternative. And you know what? Let them know that there's an alternative and that you're negotiating with the other side. Now, as a practical matter, it's hard to split your resources into two separate negotiations. So what I suggest as a practical matter is the one that you really want to do, you work that one intensively. And the one that's your backup plan, you just move it along slowly but credibly. And what I mean by credibly is it's credible that you're continuing to talk to the other side as a practical solution to, we really don't have the resources to do a negotiation times two.
I love the show. You're blowing all the secrets.
I'm educating, not blowing secrets.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks for calling. And we're speaking with Mark Grossman. He's an attorney and negotiator, authority on technology and outsourcing and technology law. And we're going to take a short break. Our number, 1-800-743-9576. Stay with us.
And we're back. It's today's topical currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and tech attorney specialist Mark Grossman. Again, our telephone number, 1-800-743-9576. We have some callers we're going to get to. Mark, before, though, we continue our negotiation skills discussion, you said to plan your concession. So you should know what concessions you will consider or accept before you go in.
You know, part of what I like to do, Joe, is look at the material issues in a deal. And for internal use only, obviously, I'll rate them 1 to 3. The ones are my must-haves. My threes are my giveaways. And then you got twos, you know, things you got to work with. And sometimes my clients say, like, why do we need to waste time on the threes? Why don't we just get rid of them? They're giveaways. And the answer is twofold. One, you'll probably get more than half of the giveaways if they're not effective negotiators, and it's nice to have them. And number two is you need things to give away, because one of the differences between a good negotiator and a great negotiator is a great negotiator causes the other side to think that they, and I'm doing air quotes here on the radio, the other side won the negotiation. And there's always this mental arithmetic going on in every deal you do, where how many concessions did I get? Well, I want to walk in with a pile of those threes.
So they're throwaways.
Well, not necessarily throwaways, but giveaways. I mean, there's a subtlety in that, yeah, in the difference of the words. I mean, I'd like to get them, but I got to give something, and I got to give a lot to get a deal.
It shows you're not demanding everything you want.
Correct. In fact, at the end of the day, I want them to privately say, boy, we got more concessions. We were really good. And it's like, okay, great. That's exactly where I want you to be. And it takes those giveaways, or throwaways, if you will, walking in with those. And, you know, I go back to earlier when I said about listening early. You know, if you're good at listening, you might be able to trade some ones and twos for threes, the giveaways. But you have to listen to discover that something is a one or two of theirs, and they would trade it for a three. It's like, yeah, and then you, like, you know, protest how you don't want to give away this three for what is a one, and you know, you kind of score some points there.
Oh, I can see listening being absolutely, you know, so germane to the negotiating process, but many people, I'm sure you've noticed in your life.
Oh, my God. I remember one time flying to San Francisco with this guy, 6 hours on an airplane. If we're going to ask questions, we're going to drill down, don't talk, don't interrupt, let the other side talk. I swear, as soon as we were done with the niceties about the weather in the nice conference room, he went on for a half hour. It was like a monologue. I'm kicking him under the table. Just couldn't get him to shut up. It happens all the time. People love to talk.
Mm-hmm.
And we have another listener on with us, Alex in Aventura. You're on. Hi.
Hi, guys. Is the ability to be a good negotiator something you can learn, or is it more of an innate quality that you just need to have to be able to read people? Because I don't know if you can teach that.
You know, it's a little of both. Reading people is probably sort of kind of innate. I mean, if you have someone who's clueless and socially awkward, it is hard to see how they're ever going to be a great negotiator. But having said that, there are techniques that you can teach that can make anybody better than they were at their starting point. Even the one who can't read people can learn to listen to people, right? I mean, as an example, you can train the mere passage of time makes the unacceptable more acceptable. So that you can train, don't tell them your budget going in. You can train, you need giveaways going in. So there's this whole host of stuff that you can train. Reading people, I don't know, maybe I should leave that one for the psychologist. I was blessed with the ability to be able to read people. If you can't, that might be a little tougher.
Okay, thanks for your call.
Thanks, Alex.
And we'll move along to Carl in Fort Lauderdale. Carl, you're up. Hi.
Hi. Hi. How are you guys doing?
Hi, Carl.
Good.
I think the attorney has some great points, amazing points, but I think you still have to set limits. I think the first thing to do, whatever you're negotiating, is to set limits, first of all, and be direct. I think people who are a little more coy and less direct, they usually end up with deals they don't like.
Hmm.
You should never give away any details. I mean, even if you think that it's going to be valuable to give something up, you shouldn't give the details away. Let them make the offer first. If you have, for instance, if you have no idea about the limits you have to set, that you're going to set for yourself, then you're going to be swayed very easily. You're going to sway with the tide because you don't know what your limits are. You have to be tough. You know, a lot of people think that being tough means that you're a con artist, but you have to be tough and determine, again, what your limits are and not go beyond that. If you haven't done your homework, so for instance, in a car dealership, if you haven't been to 5 or 6 car dealerships, then you're not going to do a good deal. If you go into the first car dealership and get that deal, you're going to be quote-unquote screwed. You're not going to really do well that way.
Hmm.
The focus needs to be get as much information as you can, know what the rates are, know what the interest rates are currently, understand what cars that are on the lot. Do your detailed research, and know when to walk away.
Let's see what Mark has to say.
So,
Carl.
Sure, go ahead, Mark.
So, Carl, I mean, you said a lot of things. I'm not sure I can address them all. but, you know, you talk about limits. I remember you talked about limits. And one of
sure.
the things that you do in your prior planning session, prior planning prevents poor performance, is you should be figuring out in advance what your reservation value is, sometimes referred to as your RV. What is your reservation value? It's your walkaway point. If I can't get this, I'm out of there. And although that might evolve based on listening and learning more, you should walk in with a reservation value. You should also walk in knowing what your best alternative to a negotiated agreement is. Sometimes referred to as BATNA, comes out of the Harvard Business School. I mean, I didn't invent these terms, but you should know what your best alternative is going in. You talked about being tough. Nothing I've said suggests that being tough is a bad idea. In fact, when tied to, you said you should always let them make the first offer. I generally agree with you. More, again, I like to be a reactive negotiator and investigational negotiator, and part of the investigation is what's the first offer going to be. Having said that, the danger is they may set anchor at a really bad or low price, let's say, when you're trying for a high price. So there is a danger in that, but then again, if they offer $40,000 and you're thinking $140,000, maybe you come back with $200,000 and move the discussion. So, you know, it's not 40-60 is where you're going, but now you've put 200 out there as a number, and you know, you have that kind of re-anchoring statement. I tried to deal with a few of the things you said, but, you know, hopefully that was responsive to at least some of it.
Okay, thanks for calling, Carl.
Okay, and we move along to Betty. Betty in Miami, hi.
Hello, hi.
Hello, Betty.
Hi, I just have a couple comments. And one is that sometimes when you're talking to people and negotiating with people, it's important to know that just because somebody's sitting across from you and they're not talking, that doesn't mean they're always listening.
Very true.
And the other comment is that never negotiate with a con artist. And they do exist. They're few and far between, I believe. But if you hear double talk and you're trying to figure out, well, I don't understand this person, and they say one thing one day, they say another thing another day, they're probably a con artist, and don't negotiate with them. And I'll just listen off here.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks, Betty.
Sounds like some bad experiences.
I think so.
Yeah.
And next up we have Lori in Miami. Lori, go ahead. You're up. Hi.
Oh, hi. I just had a question, actually an example that I wanted to give. I recently listed a condo for sale in North Miami. I'm a real estate agent here in Miami. And we got an offer, a great offer. And I guess we just couldn't come to an agreeable price. We were $9,000 off between the seller and the buyer. And the buyer made one more counter and ended up withdrawing their offer completely. Other agents said that they were just agitated and didn't want to keep going back and forth. I guess my question is, how would you handle a situation where, for example, here you have a seller that's stuck on one price and then a buyer who seems to be, you know, flexible? What are some tips to get, I guess, in this case, a seller to realize, you know, we're talking about $9,000 in the grand scheme of things, you know, and try to get them to become more agreeable, I guess.
Maybe talk about average time properties listed on the market as compared to where you are and how, what that means to when you might expect an offer, another offer. Maybe get it off of a zero-sum game. Right now you're haggling over $9,000, and I'm assuming we're talking about at least hundreds of thousands or seven figures as the purchase price here. So we're talking about an immaterial amount of money in the grand scheme of things. But part of it might be to, it's still a zero-sum game. We're just haggling price. So maybe throw in some other term. Explore where the seller, if the seller was the problem, it's like, do you need a fast closing, a slow closing? As an example, maybe you could change the closing terms in a way to accommodate the seller. Is there anything here that you that is part of the property, the refrigerator or a lighting fixture or something like that that you're emotionally attached to that you'd like to take with you? Maybe we can rework the deal and take that out of the contract so you could take it with me. The point is, I would ask a lot of questions. And I would begin to explore things other than price that might be valuable to the seller to cause the seller to budge. Don't want to be involved in a zero-sum game. And by exploring these other things like fast closing, slow closing, finance, cash deal, things like that, I'm arguably bringing value to the seller. And I talked earlier about not dividing the value, but creating new value. If they get to take their precious chandelier that's now in the contract as part of the real estate that's being sold, and they didn't speak up about it, but if you learn, you know, that chandelier came from my mother, take it. Take it.
Right.
And how about we just split the difference on the $9,000 call today? I created some value, and maybe I closed your deal.
Thank you.
Okay, sure. Lori, thanks for calling. We're speaking with attorney Mark Grossman, also a negotiator, author. He was, is this it, Lawyer of the Year for Technology Law in New York City last year, 2016?
2016, it's old hat. You know, I'm just, no, yes, it was last year.
That was just a few months ago.
Yes, it was. I'm kidding. That was Best Lawyers in America. And I'm proud of that one because it's not who's who. I didn't buy it. It's actually peer selected. My other lawyers in New York City chose me. So I'm actually proud of that one.
Okay. All right. We're going to take a short break on today's topical currents. We'll be right back and take more of your calls. And we have your emails.
And we're back. It's today's topical currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and technology law attorney Mark Grossman. Mark, we spent most of the hour on negotiations. I have one more question before perhaps we take on another topic. We have callers also that want to talk about negotiations.
Sure.
But discuss the psychology of framing.
Ah, absolutely. So an important concept in a negotiation is the frame from which you're discussing it. So if you're stuck in a negotiation and it's being termed as an annual deal, and you're talking about an annual deal and we're going to renew it every year and we're kind of stuck on price and other provisions, I could change the frame of that deal and say, what if we talked about a three-year deal? Reframed as a three-year deal, a lot of things can change that get us unstuck. I mean, we use, go back to simple car examples. We're stuck on a mid-sized car and we can't seem to agree to a price. It's like, okay, what if we reframe it as that car over there with some additional options? So we just kind of change the basic parameters of what we're talking about when we're stuck and take it somewhere else.
What about Lori's house where they were disputing the $9,000? How do you reframe that?
I don't know that I reframe that. I see that more as...
Well, he did with the chandeliers.
Right.
But I'm not sure I'd label that a reframing as much as just... Well, I guess it is a reframing. And I guess I alluded to that as added, bringing value, new value to the seller, which is, really, I can keep my mother's chandelier. There's a value to that, which may not be monetary. And the person assumes, well, it's a lighting fixture in the house. It goes with the house. If you kind of listen and say, what would you like to change other than the price? I'd love my mother's chandelier. That could be.
So that is a reframing in a way.
You got to listen, though. if you're not listening and asking questions, if you're not asking, why won't you move on this price? Because I want my mother's chandelier. That's why. Maybe I really want to stay here. I don't know. You know, just a thought.
We move along to Maddie in Deerfield Beach. Maddie, hi.
Hi. I guess this is more of an observation than a question. I just feel like now, more than ever, we should be moving away from manipulative capitalist business practices like this and moving towards a more cooperative philosophy. I mean, there are people demanding what they want right now, and nothing is heard through these business deals. It seems to be that's the only value that we have, and I wish that there was a way to use them towards a more cooperative society, as opposed to getting won over constantly on the other person.
So, interesting comment, definitely reflects a bias that I can probably predict go bang, bang, bang on a lot of views on a lot of different things. But I would just point out that listening, asking questions, and asking why, are those manipulative? Just wondering what your take is on those tactics.
Well, just listening to what you were saying earlier, looking for, you know, just thinking about the other person, what they need, thinking about how you could walk away, get the best deal, get what you want. I think listening would be a much better solution. Think about what they want, how you can both get the best out of everything. I just think this is a very outmoded way of thinking, and it's gotten our country and our society and our economy into a terrible situation, and I just think we should be working towards something different.
I think you have biases that blind you. So you talk about listening. I talked about empathy. You know, feel the other side's pain. I don't know. That doesn't. If you think that's evil, let me know. Find out what.
I didn't use the word evil. I don't think you're evil. I think that empathy should be definitely emphasized. That I'm glad you emphasized it. I think it should be number one.
Okay. I talked about finding out what they need and adding value to a situation. I don't know. I'm trying. You had a very negative take.
It sounds more manipulative to me than it does genuine empathy. It sounds more like finding out what they want so that you can use it to get what you want. That's just how I read it. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I wasn't listening.
Maybe not, because getting what you want and doing harm to the other side is not the basis for a long-term deal, whether it's in business or in life. But listening and empathy might be just a way to get what you're trying to get in a good way.
I'll just add, I think we get your point, Maddie, but one of the things he did say is about negotiating is not about winning and losing. It's about playing fair. So, but I think your point is well taken. How's that? There's
Thank
a negotiation. Did I do good, Mark?
You did great.
Okay. All right. Thanks, Maddie.
Mark, I was reminded of the negotiations and the tremendous publicity that can be on them, like in a baseball or football trade where one general manager wants to do a deal but doesn't want to make look foolish by trading player A for playing B and a player to be named later and this and that. It must be very difficult.
Oh, my God. But it's what makes it fun. Negotiations can be so dynamic, require you to think on your feet. I mean, that's why I enjoy doing it. I mean, heck, I've been wanting to do this since I was 16 and read a book called You Could Negotiate Everything by Herb Cohn. That's what got me into this, and I've always kind of enjoyed it.
Okay, I have a quick question, not on the subject of negotiation, but since you're well-versed on the subject of artificial intelligence, this really took me... Okay, so there's a new Amazon Echo look. And it's the first artificially intelligent style assistant.
Yes.
So you sent me this information. It takes full-length photos and videos to help users look their best.
Yes.
Now, come on. First of all, how does that work? And that's sort of beyond comprehension. How does Alexa know what looks good? Who's programmed Alexa? It's also subjective.
Of course it's subjective. And there's a lot of machine learning, so lots of, you know, maybe you put in, I'm making
And you look better in products they sell.
Oh, of course you do.
Well, of course. That's the point.
But you know, maybe, and I have nothing to do, no real insight into how Look was programmed, but the artificial intelligence, one thing you might do is look at fashion magazines and say to Alexa during its programming stages, all these 50,000 pictures came from fashion magazines that people think know what they're talking about. Learn the trends and the patterns in these fashion magazines. But you know, that's kind of almost the minor point.
Yeah,
on
the,
it,
big point
the big
is
point is
Amazon's going to have a camera in your house.
Correct. And the end game, I really think, remember, for those of you who remember the movie 2001, A Space Odyssey, this is how. With eyes everywhere in your home. And when Amazon has access to visual cues about what's going on in your home and audio cues about what's going on in your home, that's a lot of information and a lot of power. Now, before the paranoid, and even the paranoid do have enemies, but before the paranoid go running off wild on this, I would point out that although the Echo devices are looking and listening, they're not sending everything to Amazon in the cloud. It's only after you issue the wake word, Alexa, what time is it? When you say Alexa, Amazon gets a couple of seconds before the word Alexa, and what follows over the next few seconds, sent to it in the cloud for the artificial intelligence to analyze it and appropriately
respond. At least
respond.
They say she's not awake.
Well, yes, fair enough. How do I know? I guess I don't really. But you know what? Even Amazon can be brought down. And if it were ever pointed out, if it were ever proven that Amazon lied and all these Echo devices are streaming it up into the cloud and recording everything you say in your home, in your bedroom,
right,
in your kitchen, even Amazon can be brought down. I can't imagine in real life that they would pull a stunt like that, because I could not imagine them surviving the negative publicity and the lack of trust that would come from that. So on that basis, the check and balance of publicity and public opinion, they can't simply be listening to everything. I don't think so.
Well, on that note, Amazon is not Hal. or Hal is not Alexa, or something like that. Mark Grossman's a conference keynoter. He's a speaker, nationally recognized technology law expert, negotiator, author, and authority on technology and outsourcing. He was Lawyer of the Year for Technology Law in New York City in 2016. He's the author of Technology Law, What Every Business and Business-Minded Person Needs to Know, and hundreds of columns for several publications. And it's been a pleasure having you with us. Come back soon.
Thank you, as always.
And thanks for tuning in this hour. Apologies to those callers we couldn't get to. Our lead producer, Richard Ives. Technical direction from online producer, Jason Zabka. Polly Landis is associate producer. Many listeners take advantage of our free audio archives of each program, available at our website, wlrn.org. Follow the radio, then the topical currents link. More information at the Topical Currents Facebook page, as well as the iTunes podcast. Tomorrow's program looks at a new program ascribed by Miami-Dade County. Along with 20 other urban centers, the county has joined into the City Energy Project to cut climate pollution in office buildings. They're a chief user of wasted energy. Also Thursday, Linda Gassenheimer and Grace Della, founder of Miami Culinary Tours. The originals cover Wynwood, South Beach, and Little Havana. More details about that tomorrow. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, thanks for making Public Radio your companion today. Stay tuned for Here and Now, next from NPR News.